Welcome to Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. I'm Daniel Wilde from the Institute of Public Affairs. Australia is facing its most significant challenges since World War II. Geopolitical tensions are increasing, cultural self-confidence is in decline. The values which define us, freedom, democracy, egalitarianism, and sacrifice, are being put to the test. Over this special podcast series, Tony and I discuss how Australia can survive and flourish in the decades ahead. Well, hello, Tony, and g'day to all of our listeners. Great to be back for another episode of Australia's Future with Tony Abbott. Our discussion today is all about The Voice, Peter Dutton and the Liberals opposing The Voice to Parliament, the nature of debate and censorship. And Tony's also going to share his thoughts on the claims made by proponents of The Voice about what they say The Voice will do. Tony, great to be chatting with you again today. Let's kick off with the biggest part of today's discussion, which is Peter Dutton, who recently established that the Liberal Party will be formally opposing Anthony Albanese's proposal for a voice to Parliament. Dutton said that the voice will not unite us, it will divide us, that it won't fix problems in remote communities, and it will be just another elitist Canberra bureaucracy. To me, this is important political leadership, critical to our nation's future. So good on Dutton for doing this. Tony, just to get your thoughts and reflections on this development.
Well, Dan, like you, I admire what Peter Dutton has done. And I think that it's important that the Liberal Party oppose this voice, not because we don't feel generous towards Indigenous Australians. Of course we do. And not because we don't want to see Indigenous people recognised in the Constitution. Of course we do. But this voice is the wrong way of doing it. As you and I have been discussing for months now, Dan, this voice is wrong in principle. It would be disastrous in practice. And the Prime Minister is really trying to stampede us into voting yes to the voice based on the vibe. He's asking us to sign a constitutional blank cheque for something which would quite definitely be the biggest constitutional change Australians have ever been asked to make. And he's asking us to make it without a convention, without any deep discussion, without any of the fine details of exactly how this voice would operate, exactly how it would be elected or appointed, exactly how it would relate to the various arms and agencies of government. So it's an absolutely massive change that we are being rushed into on the basis of goodwill, because plainly the Prime Minister's view is that if we understood what we were doing, we wouldn't do it. That's why he's trying to get us to do it in a hurry without any detail based on the vibe.
I think you're right. I mean, the polls show that the more people learn about the voice, the less they like it. Once they learn it's in the Constitution, once they're aware that it's Indigenous only participation, they don't want to be involved in that. Tony, you know, reflecting on your high effectiveness as a campaigner and your capacity for very clear communication, how do you think this will now shape the debate? I mean, to me, the biggest thing is we're actually going to have a debate, which is the most important thing. But your reflections, given your history of campaigning.
Well, if it were me, I'd basically be saying over and over again, Australians for constitutional equality should oppose this activist voice, because I believe that we do believe in constitutional equality. We're all equal before the law. Doesn't matter whether your forebears have been here 60,000 years or whether you got off the plane a week ago. Once you're an Australian citizen, everyone is equal. Again, look at how this voice will work. Almost inevitably, it's going to be comprised of activists, activists with a grievance, and you can be absolutely certain that this voice will immediately have a very big agenda. At the top of the agenda will be things like changing the date of Australia Day, trying to negotiate treaties between the Commonwealth government and various Indigenous groups. And the bottom line for all this is going to be more money. And we're already spending something like $40 billion a year at a federal level on Indigenous-specific programs, according to the Productivity Commission. There'll be even more under this, and I suspect down the track a lot of aspects of ordinary life which are currently governed, perhaps over-governed, in ways we understand, will have an additional layer of Indigenous governance on top of them. And as I said, we should not do this on the basis simply of goodwill towards Indigenous people, because in the end, I fear that this will divide our country as never before if it happens the way the government currently plans.
Well, Tony, it won't surprise a lot of our viewers and listeners to learn that it was just 24 minutes after Dutton's announcement for when accusations of racism emerged. And the first was Adam Bandt, who said, quote, the Liberals are a small racist rump sliding into irrelevance, end quote. Noel Pearson, you will have seen, said it was a Judas betrayal of our country and that Dutton was the undertaker of the Uluru Statement. And previously, those such as Marsha Langdon, who's the referendum working group member and one of the lead advocates of The Voice, has defended the government's position, saying anyone who questions The Voice or the legal consequences are subconsciously racist. Tony, doesn't this give us an indication of the sort of where we're going, the tone of the debate? And like you rightly say, advocates don't want to debate the substance. They just want to label those who disagree with them as having nefarious motives. What are your thoughts?
Look, I'm very disappointed that people like Noel Pearson in particular have played the man and not the ball here. Now, I've worked with Noel over the years on all sorts of things, and in many respects, I admire Noel on lots and lots of issues. He's been both right and brave, but on this, he's got a my way or the highway approach. I laughed the other day when Noel said of the Voice debate, when they go low, we go high. We meet hatred with love, and then proceeded to abuse Peter Dutton as a Judas undertaker, doing what he did to save his miserable political skin. So really, please, Noel, a little bit of self-awareness. But look, I guess... that's really what it boils down to. The Prime Minister is saying to us, in effect, if you don't do this, you don't respect Aboriginal people. Now, I think almost every Australian, to a man and a woman, respects Aboriginal people, wants Aboriginal people to have a place of pride and honour as the first Australians, is very proud of the fact that we have an Indigenous heritage, as well as a British foundation and an immigrant character, as I keep saying. But that doesn't mean we have to do something to ourselves that in the end is going to be divisive and gravely counterproductive. There are better ways of recognising Indigenous people than this bad voice. There are better ways of respecting Indigenous people than to divide our country on the basis of race. And I just think people need to know that you can be a good and decent Australian, an Australian who respects Aboriginal people, and still say no to this activist voice on the basis of a respect for constitutional equality.
And Tony, you're speaking with some authority because as Prime Minister and opposition leader, you spent more time than any of your colleagues in equivalent position in remote Indigenous communities. I believe you spent about a week per year in places like the East Arnhem Land in you know, very remote circumstances and conditions. One of the criticisms of The Voice levelled by Dutton and many others is that, look, another Canberra-based bureaucracy is not going to be able to deal or improve with, you know, conditions on the ground in these kind of communities. You know, based on your on-the-ground experience, can you give us some insights as to why another Canberra bureaucracy probably won't get the job done?
Yeah, Dan. Really, from my earliest days in Parliament, I tried to spend a bit of time every year in remote Australia. as a backbencher in opposition in the mid-1990s. I went out to Alice Springs every year for a couple of years, spent a bit of time in some of the remote communities around Alice Springs, spent a bit of time with the legendary Charlie Perkins, who was an interesting character. And then as a minister in the Howard government, I tried to spend a few days every year in remote Australia in connection with my various portfolios. As health minister, I had a whole of government responsibility for the APY lands in northern Australia, northern South Australia. I spent plenty of time there. Then I was shadow minister for Indigenous Affairs in opposition. I spent 3 weeks as a teacher's aide in an Indigenous, largely Indigenous school in Cowan in Cape York. I then spent a couple of weeks, if you like, as an assistant truancy officer at the school at Arakoon. Then when I became opposition leader, I spent more time at Arakoon. I spent some time in and around Hope Vale. As Prime Minister, I had a week in East Arnhem Land. And then the following year, I had a week up in the Torres Strait because I figured that our governmental leaders owed it to Indigenous people and to remote Australia, not just to study the issue from Canberra, but to try to actually go on the ground. Why not spend 1 week a year, 1/50th, 2% of your time in remote Australia in acknowledgement of the fact that this is a very important part of our country? So look, I think I did walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Mm. But what was obvious to me from all my time in remote Australia is that we've got to get the kids to school, we've got to get the adults to work, and we've got to keep the communities safe. Mm. And at the heart of our problem is this constant sense that Indigenous people are somehow different and have to be treated in a different way to other Australians. Mm. It's this underlying separatism which is at the heart of so much of the difficulty, because if we don't have the same expectations of Aboriginal people in terms of their schooling, in terms of their employment, in terms of the way they live, obviously we're going to have different and lesser outcomes. I mean, if kids don't go to school, they're not going to have jobs. Mm. If people don't have jobs, they're not going to have money. If people don't have money, they're not going to be able to live well and to be housed well and so on. So we have to get right away from this sense of difference and separatism, because in essence, what we have in common is far more important than anything that divides us. And again, to get back to this voice, it's based on this sense that Aboriginal people are somehow different and have to be treated in a way that is somehow separate from the ways that everyone else is treated.
Mm. No, well said, Tony. I think we'd be a lot better off if the bureaucrats were out in remote places rather than being based in Canberra.
Mm.
I want to turn to another part, and you touched on this a little bit earlier, Tony, which is the arguments that many proponents of The Voice make as to why they believe The Voice is necessary. We've heard the Prime Minister say, for example, that The Voice is about recognition and consultation. Mm-hmm. Arguments have always also been made that it's just good manners, that it's the polite thing to do, and that nothing else has worked. Mm-hmm. Tony, based on what you've just reflected on, your time in remote communities and your time as Prime Minister and opposition leader, what do you make of these arguments? Do they hold any water?
Well, I don't believe they do hold water. Being polite and decent to people doesn't mean indulging something that would be counterproductive. We know within our own families, we want the best for them, but that doesn't mean simply doing whatever they want. Mm. So we've got to get this right rather than in a surfeit of goodwill do something that in the end is going to be counterproductive. Now, read Warren Mundine's memoirs, for instance. I mean, Warren's written a wonderful account of his life, and all of it's of great interest, but just as interesting as what Noel has, as what Warren has done, is the account of his parents' life. Now, his parents grew up in the 30s and 40s, and that was a time when there were some legal, there was still legal discrimination against Indigenous people in some areas. But they were never on welfare. They always had a job. They bought their own house. They sent their kids to school. And okay, they weren't well off, but they were decent, self-respecting people who were having a go. And despite the difficulties, they made it in the wider Australian community. And they were very well respected up on the North Coast in Grafton where they lived. So, look, the future for all Australians is just to muck in together and to make the most of things. And sure, we'll have different backgrounds, we'll have different political views, we'll have different interests and aptitudes, but the job for all of us is to have a go and make the most of things. And this stress on difference, this focus on separate development is extremely counterproductive. I think in many ways Indigenous Australia was going okay in the 1960s. Then, of course, we had changes to employment. We had the extension of welfare. We had sit-down money. Now, I think that was the a really important wrong turn, and I think that is that has been very much at the heart of our problems ever since. And I think this voice is going to make a bad situation worse, not better.
Tony, I just want to turn to, I guess, the last part of our conversation on The Voice today, and that's to do with the nature of the debate and censorship and the stacking of the deck in favour of the Yes case. The first part I wanted to touch on is the role of civic organisations and especially sporting codes and sporting bodies and sports stars. For example, the Collingwood AFL Football Club, I think, was the first out of the gates a couple of weeks ago to say that they're going to be supporting The Voice to Parliament. The Prime Minister only a day or two ago said that sports stars such as Adam Goodes and Cathy Freeman would be campaigning for the Yes case. Now, on the one hand, you know, every Australian is free to have their opinion and voice their perspective on the matter, no matter what it is. But at the same time, for me, this is quite divisive. Half of the people rocking up to a footy game or a rugby game or the cricket, they're going to be either no or unsure, and they're going to feel excluded as a result of this. And this is a long pattern of repeated behaviour by major sporting bodies and teams to take a stand on divisive political issues. Tony, what's your perspective on these kind of matters?
Like you, Dan, I accept that sports stars have got as much right as everyone else to a view. But we don't look up to them because of their views on politics. We look up to them because of their excellence on the field. And I think there's always a bit of a risk when sports stars go beyond their area of expertise and competence, so to speak. If they want to do it, fine. But I'm not sure, A, that they do themselves that much good, and B, that they do the cause that much good. I can remember very well back in the day of the Republican debate here in Australia, lots of celebrities came out and said, we need an Australian head of state. And I think every time a celebrity tried to browbeat people into having a particular view, people tended to get their backs up and say, well, you can think that and you can do that, but hey, I'm going to make up my own mind. I'm going to do my own thing. So look, by all means, let's hear what these various sports personalities think. But in the end, it's what the majority of Australians think. And I just worry that by trying to frog march us into doing this, without a convention, without a long debate, without really any real bipartisanship, the Prime Minister is taking us to a place where we really shouldn't go. I always said, as Prime Minister, that recognition had to be a unifying act. It had to be something that brought us together. It had to be something for everyone, not just a concession to a particular group in the community. And you might remember, Dan, back in mid-2015, Bill Shorten, the then opposition leader, and I sat down in Sydney with about 40 significant Indigenous leaders to chart a way forward. And the idea back then was that there would be a series of dialogues, not just Indigenous dialogues, but a series of dialogues right around the country leading up most likely to a constitutional convention. And from that would emerge a proposal. But again, it was always something that I thought would have to have bipartisan support. Now, from the very beginning, the Prime Minister has approached this essentially on a take-it-or-leave-it basis. He announced his form of words at GAMA. Sure, he took Julian Leeser along for the ride, but there was no sense that Julian Leeser was really involved in what happened. And while he's constantly demanded bipartisanship from the opposition, it's essentially been acquiescence that he's wanted from the opposition. And I can very much understand why it's the process as much as the outcome which people have found uncomfortable and in the end are having trouble accepting.
Yeah, I think it was you who might have remarked recently that it really needs to be an 80% plus proposition. I mean, even if you're winning 70-30, that's going to divide the country, and certainly at the moment it's looking like a 55-45 at best.
Constitutional change should never be a winner-takes-all business. Constitutional change has got to be something which is, if not exactly done by consensus, it's got to be done on an overwhelming basis if we are to go forward together as a united nation.
Which is what we had in 67, 90%. Exactly. And that was really a couple of decades. And it was the coalition that led that, ultimately the referendum in 1967 after a couple of decades of discussion. That's really what it takes. Tony, I want to just turn to another facet of the debate, and we can probably end on this note, which is to do with censorship. And you've had a lot to say about big tech and government censorship of debate. We had the e-safety commissioner, who's a government appointed individual with an office, Julie Inman Grant, at a press conference on the 28th of March at Parliament House. She stated that social media companies would, quote, be on notice during the referendum debate, and that key words that might be used to silence voices and misinformation and disinformation needed to be dealt with by these online platforms, and they had obligations, quote unquote, to minimise online hate, end quote. Now, at a surface level, there's nothing objectionable about saying you want to have a civil debate and limit online hate speech and so forth. The issue here, Tony, is that the eSafety Commissioner is an official of the Commonwealth Government, and we know that the government is completely all in on the voice to Parliament, which means that in all likelihood, this office is going to be weaponised, in my assessment, against the no case. To me, this is also just another example of how the government, big tech, big corporates, we've talked about sporting codes, are going all in to censor debate and limit the ability of the no case to express their views. I just wanted to get your reflections on the eSafety Commissioner specifically and the broader sort of censorship matter more broadly.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. Look, I think there is a real danger of censorship here. We've already seen instances. The IPA itself has had some of its broadcasts, at least for a time, taken down, or you've had some restraints put on you.
That's right.
Advance Australia, another organisation that I'm connected with, has had material rejected by big tech. So I think it is very important that Australians are allowed to speak their minds. And look, it'll be robust. So far, I think that the hate speech, to the extent that there's been any, has been more from the yes camp than from the no camp.
That's right.
We were talking about some examples of that earlier, but I think it's very important that Australians be allowed to speak their mind, and I think it's very important that there be a level playing field. And my fear is that the government is going to fund a campaign against misinformation, which will essentially be propaganda for the yes case. Now, again, if we are going to do this, we have to do it on the basis of a full and frank and fair debate. And I hope that that will be allowed, not just by the government, but by all the various agencies of government.
All right, Tony, thanks again for your insights and analysis. I know you've got a plane to catch shortly, so we will end it there for today. So thank you again, Tony, and we'll keep chatting.
Good on you, Daniel.
This is a production of the Centre for the Australian Way of Life at the Institute of Public Affairs. To find out more, visit australia.ipa.org.au.